It's another one of those weeks where there's been plenty of news to cover here on the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup. From the 9th District to the General Assembly, and WFAE's reporters are able to cover it all because of your financial support. Continue that investment right now at 704-549-9000 or hit the donate button at WFAE.org. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Republican legislators in the North Carolina House pull a fast one on Democrats, finding a time when few Democrats are there and then voting to override the governor's budget veto. We have the fallout. Dan Bishop is packing his bags and heading to Congress, the winner in the long-delayed 9th Congressional District race. City Council primaries yield a few surprises, but give us a well-defined preview of the outcome of the general election in November. And Sheriff Gary McFadden makes headlines again, speaking out against his critics, including the vice president. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison from WFA News. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Daniel Shemtob is with us. She's a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is back. He's editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Hello.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio. We're all on Facebook Live. What could be better? There was a surprise vote this week in the North Carolina House in which, after months of a stalemate, they successfully overrode the governor's veto of the budget. It began quietly, and then all hell broke loose.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House pass House Bill 966, the 2019 Appropriations Act, notwithstanding the objections of the governor.
House Bill 966, clerk will read.
What?
Objection. Johnson, Lambert,
objection, Sam, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, objection. We were told that there is no vote today. Objection.
Further discussion. Further
Mr.
debate.
Speaker.
Not the question for the House.
Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order. We were told that there will be no votes this morning.
That was not announced.
There was a public announcement, Mr. Speaker. This is a tragedy. This is a travesty of the process, and you know it.
The vote was 55-9 and was held because most of the Democrats opposed to the override were not there. Democratic Representative Deb Butler was.
How dare you subject this body to trickery, deceptive practices, hijacking the process? We have been here day and night for months defending what we believe. If this is the way you believe democracy works, shame on you!
So, Democrats allege that they were told there would be no votes that morning, the morning of September the 11th, and Republicans seem to know that there would be a vote. Why the confusion?
I think what happened was Darren Jackson was told, he says he was told by David Lewis in the House that we're not going to vote in the morning. There may be votes in the afternoon, but nothing in the morning. And David Lewis had also texted a reporter saying the same thing. The House Speaker, Tim Moore, like his fingerprints aren't on this in a way, and that, like, I think it's clear he did not, there was no official announcement. Nothing came out of his office, but clearly the Democrats thought that nothing was going to happen. And what, 10 were there? 12?
Yeah. Were they not supposed to not vote so that would allow people to go to some memorial service for 9/11?
Well, I think 9/11 came, obviously, because it was 9/11, and there were at least some people who were at 9/11 memorial events. And then the governor, of course, made that a focal point of his criticism of the decision to take the vote.
Well, as you might imagine, House Speaker Tim Moore, a Republican, was unapologetic and reiterated the Democrats had been warned this would happen.
I've made it clear. I've said right here from where I am, on the floor, everywhere, if I see an opportunity to override this budget, this veto, I was going to take that vote.
So given that, do Democrats have anyone to be angry with other than themselves?
Well, I think, you know, people who have covered politics in the state for a long time have pointed out that versions of this have happened before, but there is a feeling certainly among Democrats and some others that this was perhaps a new extreme. But Speaker Moore was very straightforward about the approach. They were going to find a way to do this if they could, and they did it. So,
and he was asked in that news conference specifically about 9/11 and the appropriateness of this.
Yeah.
And he just kind of brushed it off and said, show up, do your job, be ready.
Democrats have called this, of course, an unspeakable thwarting of justice. That's a quote. And the Observer editorial page agreed. Is that what this is? Or is this just a clever parliamentary maneuver? And it's certainly legal. As the Observer pointed out this morning, there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't do this.
It's legal. I'm not sure that I can cast a final judgment, but I think one of the obvious conclusions here is the lack of trust, and the way that this, that when you have situations like this, the way it further frays an already very partisan body. So it certainly may move the budget along, but it's not going to help them in terms of finding consensus on all the other issues that they have to negotiate.
So I'm going to ask you, Danielle, to defend the editorial board of The Observer. I'm just kidding. Because in an editorial, The Observer wrote, quote, not only was the House vote dishonest, it was carried out by a Republican majority that courts have repeatedly found to have gained seats through illegal gerrymandering. It was an illegitimate majority acting in an unethical way. These Republicans may be incapable of shame, but North Carolinians should be outraged, first by gerrymandering and now by a high-handed vote. Something new has been taken from them. It is called democracy, quote, end quote. Reasonable assessment, or is that just the rantings of a liberal newspaper?
I think it is a reasonable assessment. What we saw here is not the way democracy is supposed to work. It got through the House. There's still the Senate. I think it just poisons the well further, as Eric said. It just diminishes the chances of bipartisan cooperation with anything.
Well, this is everything that's been going on here and around the country with Republicans is right out of the Lee Atwater playbook, which is, he's ancient history now, but back in the 80s.
Reagan, the Elder Bush.
And he told me once, in politics, the ends always justify the means.
But in the end, even he admitted and acknowledged that he was wrong.
Yes, he did. Nobody seems to remember that. Yeah. Republicans lost their supermajority, for those of you who have forgotten about that, in the last election, and with it the ability to override gubernatorial vetoes. But they still hold a majority. And in the absence of Democrats, that's what happened. They can exercise their power. The stalemate with the governor has been over Medicaid expansion. And as you might imagine, Roy Cooper was not pleased with this turn of events.
On a day when tragedy united our country, we should be standing together despite party. But instead, Republicans pulled their most deceptive stunt yet.
So I'm going to ask a question that I know the answer to, but I have to ask it. When Democrats were in control, did they ever do anything this clever?
All together now.
The News and Observer had a story this morning that kind of like retraced some of the other maneuvers in the past, and they were interesting. And the lottery vote
in 2005 is one of the more notorious ones.
But I read that, and it was kind of all in the similar ballpark. But just kind of reading it, I was like, this still seemed to be on a different category.
Yeah,
really?
And I think particularly being on 9/11, that seemed to resonate with people frustrated by this. It seemed to make it a little worse, a little more salt in the wound.
Well, this isn't over, because this is just the House passing the override. It has to go now to the Senate. What is likely to happen there?
Well, they only need one. They need
one Democrat.
They need one Democrat. And
wouldn't that be political suicide for that one Democrat to cross the aisle on this vote?
They need one, but because there were four Democrats who had voted for the Republican budget earlier, but I talked to one of those was Floyd McKissick. I talked to him last night, and he said he thinks all the Democrats are going to support the governor. So I think it's really five. I think if you're a Democrat now, even if you support the budget, I don't see how you can vote to override, go against the governor, and also kind of like in a way justify or sanction what just happened in the House.
It was interesting. The governor was in Asheville yesterday for the Charlotte Business Alliance retreat, and he spent almost all of his time imploring the business leaders in the room to contact legislators and ask for some sort of compromise. And as you mentioned, Medicaid, he mentions this all the time. In fact, he campaigned on it. The fact that you would add 400,000 people to be covered, it would add $4 billion to the economy. And he's hoping to make that kind of argument to try and get some sort of compromise. The other thing the governor is saying a lot these days is that he has offered compromise versions on the budget and hasn't really gotten any counteroffer. So that's the view from the governor's
office. Legislature they've been passing these mini budget bills as a way to work around the veto. How would the actual passage of the budget be different from these mini budget bills that they've been passing as a workaround and getting things done anyway? Would it make a difference if they passed the budget or if they didn't pass the budget? They'll just keep doing this in a different way.
Well, you're not getting the entire comprehensive budget that way. I mean, they haven't passed that many different pieces. And remember, right now what is happening is we're 2 months plus into operating off of the prior budget. So there are things, which we've talked about on the show, that are not being funded because you don't have the new budget passed.
When we come back, we will be talking about the Citizens Review Board chair who was arrested, I believe, yesterday in Myrtle Beach, and the story of Mr. Bishop going to Washington, starring Jimmy Stewart. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. Daniel Shemtop from the Charlotte Observer. Steve Harrison from WFAE News. And Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Back to politics in a moment. But first, yesterday, we found out that the chair of the Citizens Review Board, that's the organization that reviews appeals by citizens who file complaints about police, Henry Thomas Black Jr. was arrested in Myrtle Beach on sexual assault charges involving children. What exactly did they charge him with?
There were a number of charges. Basically,
multiple counts of statutory rape, statutory sex offense, indecent liberties with children, child abuse, sexual act, and incest.
What they're alleging is that these acts took place over a 22-year period. Victims were children when this alleged assault began, and it continued into their adulthood. They're both adults now. They also alleged that they went to other adults to report what was happening to them, and those adults did nothing, which would also be illegal.
Did they report it as children?
That is unclear. That was my understanding that they did, but that was not clear.
Because they've come forward again now, and people are paying attention. Why now and not before?
Well, because they went to the police. After going to adults, allegedly,
right.
We have to remember that these are just allegations at this point. The adults did nothing, and they finally went to the police.
So if these allegations, and they're only allegations, but if these allegations turn out to be true, would they then go after the adults that they reported this to previously because the adults took no action?
They are investigating that now. That would be a crime, and they are investigating.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll keep our eye on that going forward. After 2 years of campaigning in the 9th Congressional District race, it finally ended this week, 308 days after the midterm election, as Republican Dan Bishop emerged as the winner with a more than 2-point win over Democrat Dan McCready.
I'm going to Washington with clear eyes and a steel spine.
And for Dan McCready, it was the end of 27 months of campaigning.
Our mission to bring this country together, this was never a mission that could be accomplished in a single election. We didn't win this campaign tonight, but there is no doubt in my mind that our efforts over the last 27 months moved our country forward.
Can that be right? If the margin of victory by Dan Bishop was greater than that of Mark Harris in the previous election? Did he move the country forward?
The argument they made is that, you know, Trump won the district in 2016 by, I believe it was 12 percentage points, and McCready only lost to Bishop by 2 percentage points. So the Democrats were kind of making the argument that, you know, they're gaining ground in some of these areas, and especially, you know, in Mecklenburg County.
I mean, just like I say, the National Democrats, the day before the race, were already starting to spin a little bit or prepare, you know, for the possible bad news. And they were saying they have they hold only three House seats in the entire country that were more red than this one. I think it's Oklahoma. Only three House seats that are more challenging.
You and I spoke about this on the morning after the election. In the fall, McCready lost to Mark Harris by 905 votes, unless the vote total has changed since Wednesday morning. Dan Bishop beat McCready by 4,160 votes. What does that tell us?
The I talked to McCready's campaign yesterday, and it was interesting. They were... they said, well, you know, we were surprised we did as well as we did in Mecklenburg this time. They thought they'd maxed it out back in the fall. They said they expected the rural counties to be softer for them, to not have as much support. They felt like that it was just harder to get out their vote in a special election. There were no local races, which is interesting when you kind of take both of those together, that you think, like, well, how did what was your path forward to win? If you thought you would, you know.
Yeah, right.
Couldn't match your performance before and you still lost. It's just kind of interesting.
And the other thing is, Mike, you're mentioning those totals. The difference or the gap increased. And remember, there were 100,000 fewer votes this time than in November. So...
Well, the Democrats would have liked an election, liked a victory here, because it would have mean one. It would have meant A, one more Democrat in the House of Representatives, and B, it would have been one more Democrat incumbent in the fall in the House of Representatives. And yet they didn't come down here and support him very much, and he didn't seem to want their support very much. And that, I think, was a critical mistake.
So I talked to the campaign about that. We talked on the show earlier this week.
Right.
I mean, I think most of the Democratic presidential candidates would not have worked. But what about Joe Biden, right?
But Barack Obama.
Barack Obama, you know.
Well,
Obama.
Mrs.
Pence came down here for Dan Bishop.
We talked about this a little bit last week on the roundup, Mike. Remember this whole idea of party over country? I always think that's...
Country over party.
Oh, I'm sorry, country over party. Party over country is probably what it should have been. It was country over party. But I'm always a little bit baffled when you see this happen. A lot of times when there's an unpopular incumbent president, for example, someone running for senator will say, oh, well, I'm not going to have President X come down here. Is anybody fooled by that? That, you know, if you're a Republican senator, that you're not supporting Trump or whatever the scenario is. So I thought that was probably a mistake.
The other thing that I think hurt McCready this time around, Republican ads were much more effective, I believe, this time. I think they went after him in a much more substantive way and in a broader way.
What was
way
it true?
I mean,
the allegations about his solar business are simply not true.
Well, most political ads are you know,
okay,
whatever.
They
but
stretch the truth.
They stretch the truth.
They bear a faint resemblance to.
But
it.
But
those
I thought
alternative
they were,
facts.
I thought they were much more effective this time around than before.
This was one of the most expensive House races in terms of outside spending as well, like across the country. I think it was the second highest amount of outside spending ever.
For a special election.
For a special election, sorry, yeah.
Steve, I thought your story was interesting about this, 75-80% of Bishop's money going into eastern counties, because obviously that's where he flipped a couple of counties and really made up a lot of ground.
Yeah, the Bishop's campaign said, look, we thought that Mecklenburg and Union was that there were no persuadable voters. Everyone had made up their mind. We couldn't change. It was just a base election. Get your people out. They felt like that they could.
Well, Jim Blaine, who is Bishop's chief strategist, told you in that conversation that has been their strategy all along.
There's a shifting coalition for Republicans and Democrats now, and that ex-urban, rural, small-town voters that for years have voted for Democrats because they believe that Democrats have their interests at heart, have changed their mind, and that Republicans now have an opportunity.
Wasn't that always the case down there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think like some of the counties are getting, some of those rural counties are getting a little more red, and that McCready's performance, I think we'll look back at last fall, that it was just exceptional. That he did, it was a real outlier how well he did in places like Robeson and Cumberland, Richmond. And then I think this election was just kind of brought them back to normal, to their normal performance.
The best news, of course, is that filing begins in December.
Yes.
And because I was worried.
Begins again.
Yeah, because I was worried I was going to have this long drought between ad seasons. But in fact, it won't be much longer before they're back. There's a March primary.
So this race was positioned as a potential bellwether for Donald Trump in 2020. And Trump gloated in a phone call he made, I believe, to Dan Bishop shortly after the results were announced.
They had him written off and he didn't stand for CNN and MSNBC and all of the fake news. They were going to have a big night tonight. And Dan handled pressure like the greatest athletes can handle pressure.
The president practices the politics of grievance, which is interesting since he is in the catbird seat. Nothing to be grieved about. But he may be right about MSNBC rooting for Dan McCready. Do you think he is about CNN? Do you think CNN was planning a big night, or were they just planning a big night of coverage of an election of interest?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best answer I can give you is I hope that people at major networks are not pulling for people who if they are reporters. One thing I wanted to point out about Trump, he sent out a tweet saying that Bishop was down by 17 points in this race. There is not a time ever that he was down by 17 points. So that was a
where does he get these numbers?
He really made it sound like Dewey defeats Truman.
Right.
Like,
yeah. I mean, the whole tweet was the fact that he, in essence, spurred the victory. Not surprising. But
so the president's statement wasn't entirely correct.
Yeah, I know you're shocked by that, Glenn. I want to apologize.
I'm actually surprised he had time to make that phone call
because
I'm sure he's focused on recovery efforts in Alabama from the hurricane.
That was sharp, E.
So this was this race a bellwether? And if so, what does it tell you?
It says that. I would say, I mean, for Democrats, they're going to say that college-educated, affluent voters are still turned off by the president, and they are even more turned off than they were 6 months ago. And the Republican side, you know, they say, well, that's okay. We can make up for it. We'll get traditional Democratic voters, and we'll still win.
So it confirms the rural-urban divide.
Right.
Once again, the urban areas went for McCready. The rural areas went for Bishop.
And I think when looking at McCready, it's almost, you know, because he did so many things, country over party, not talking about HB2, staying away from lightning rod social issues, and yet he still couldn't persuade those rural voters.
And he's
a veteran. That's right. I mean, the military, how important is that when you're talking about going into Fayetteville and other parts of the state?
Do you think he leaned – it almost became – maybe I was just cynical, but it almost became comical that I'm a Marine. That mantra didn't seem – it seemed hollow. He was a Marine. He did serve. That's nothing to be to make light of. He did. But it just seemed to not hold any weight for some reason.
I think it may have carried more weight the first time than the second time. I think the second time maybe voters were looking for something else.
More substance.
We had already heard that. Yeah. We knew that about him.
Right.
So when he comes back with that same message, what do you have new for us?
How much of this is simply that this seat has been in Republican hands since 1963 when John F. Kennedy was the president, and it hasn't changed out of Republican hands? And if that's what it is, it's just solidly Republican, what does that portend for 2020? And who will the Democrats pick?
Well, and I think that goes
run against Dan Bishop.
I think that's what Steve is pointing to. That you know, just depending on the party, they're going to make that argument. Republicans are going to say, "See, we're still very strong in this type of district," and the Democrats are going to say, as Steve and Danielle said, "Look, we took a district that was plus 12 for Trump and made it a plus 2. So that shows that we're making inroads." And the truth of it is, we can all make predictions, but we're not going to know until November 2020. Yeah.
So there were also primaries in Charlotte for city council and mayor on Tuesday. Vi Lyles won handily and will face Republican David Michael Rice, a perennial candidate, in November.
And hopefully the city will elect its first two-term mayor in recent history.
Mayor Vi Lyles on election night. Vi took 87% of the vote. That would make her the first mayor to win a second term if she wins in November since Democrat Anthony Fox in 2011. Any surprises in the at-large council races?
I would say, I don't know, it was at least a mild surprise that there seemed to be no retribution or blowback for the vote on the RNC. I mean, nobody, they all won easily. Of course, Greg Phipps is not running again, but other than that,
I think though.
But Braxton Winston was the biggest vote getter, and he was very much opposed to it.
Yeah.
Could that be read as a response to that?
I think, though, Julie Eisele finished fourth, and so she advanced, and so she'll be on council. Mm-hmm. But. You know, her showing was a little weak compared to her past history. I think she felt like, even though she did, quote, win and advanced, that the RNC vote did hurt her, that there was, you know, people who were...
The Larkin Eggleston in District 1, that he was considered, you know, he was the deciding vote. And there was a lot of talk months ago that this could really boomerang on him. And
he won handily.
He 73%.
Yeah.
I think a lot of political watchers expected Luana Mayfield to actually make the field.
Really?
I heard a lot of conversations in the community about which one of the incumbents would not be there next year, assuming she would be. So I think a lot of people were actually surprised that she did not make the top four.
I was a little surprised that Victoria Namasiki, I thought she might push Edriggs a little bit more, but it was 68-32 in District 7.
So all of the incumbents, except for Luana, but she was changing from a district seat to an at-large seat. All of the at-large incumbents, they won, every one of them. Although Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eisele just barely squeaked into this, and to me that was kind of a surprise. Braxton Winston was the biggest vote-getter, as we said. Was that a surprise?
A little bit, although I think Steve's logic, or was it Steve or you? I can't remember. Whoever said, you know, perhaps his strong opposition to the RNC, I think that might have factored into it. And he does have a lot of name recognition. He's out and
about. Braxton, one more thing. In South Charlotte, Braxton did great.
Yeah.
Julie Eisele was first in most of those precincts, but Braxton ran really, really strong.
When we come back, there's more to talk about with the council races, and we also spoke to a presidential candidate on this program this week. We'll talk about that, and Sheriff McFadden, and some goings-on in the Plaza Midwood area with real estate, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, along with Daniel Shemtov from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. There's a couple of things left to talk about, I suppose, in these at-large city council races. There was a robocall that I was unaware of that went out this week. Against, on election day, or the day before the election, against Luana Mayfield. What's that all about?
So there is a group called Forward Charlotte that was started back in 2017. It was a political group, not entirely political, but they were kind of opposed to Jennifer Roberts, and they were going to, and then also supported Kenny Smith in the general election when he lost to Vi Lyles. They say they are now kind of a good government, pro-business organization, and so they did. They spent a few thousand dollars on a robocall throughout the city that criticized Mayfield, and it went back to a discussion in the city council budget debate when she floated the idea of taking some money from police training that could possibly pay for salary increases for council members.
Mm-hmm. So Braxton Winston, of the at-large candidates, all of the incumbents got in except for the District 5 incumbent running for at-large. But Braxton got 19.4% of the vote, and he bested James Mitchell, who's been on council far longer and is kind of he's kind of a leader on council. He came in with 17%. Dimple Ajmera bested Julie Eisele. Any explanation for the ranking or the number of votes?
Well, I was telling Glenn and I were talking about this a little bit during the break. One of the things about James Mitchell is he really doesn't campaign much. He never has, but he's been on council
forever,
since I think 99 was his first term, and he was maybe out for one or two terms. So he's been on for basically 20 years. And as Glenn said, name recognition so powerful. So in that sense, not surprising that he would be in the top couple candidates. But Braxton certainly makes a lot more news. Braxton Winston certainly makes a lot more news. He's in a lot more hot button issues. Yeah.
And he had, like I said earlier, he had support, pretty strong support throughout the entire city.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting when you look at this race and you kind of think about, okay, so Mayor Lyles is unbeatable right now, but she won't be mayor forever. And you kind of look at, like, okay, well, who's
didn't he run for mayor before?
James Mitchelton lost a cannon
right
in the primary. So who would be the next mayor? And, you know, you kind of look at this at large field, and I think you'd have to look at, you know, Braxton, Dimple Ajmera, Julie Isolt. It's interesting to kind of watch the next person rise and see who it's going to be.
So some speculate that Luana might have been eyeing a run for the mayor at some point down the road, and that might explain her decision to give up her district and run at large. She has not told me that, and I have not heard her indicate that. But I have heard people speculate that, just as Steve said, that might have been something she looked at.
I think it's interesting when you're looking at, you know, Braxton, and we were talking about, is part of this because he opposed the RNC coming here? I do think it's interesting to look at, though, because Luana has been one of the most outspoken critics of it coming here, and, you know, she did not win an at-large bid. So it's I'm curious to know, you know, what was the blowback, you know, how much of that was because people were opposed to the RNC versus, you know, other issues.
And that is a good point, because she was clearly the only council member that said from the outset, absolutely not, I don't want this in Charlotte.
Except Braxton is at large and has been at large in this first term on city council. So people maybe knew him more than they knew Luana from District 5, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah.
District 1, we already said Larkin Eggleston easily won his race. In District 2, former state senator Malcolm Graham handily beat three challengers, coming away with 61.13% of the vote. Is that, once again, a case of better name recognition, or were there other factors that came into play in that race?
I think name recognition was a huge factor there, as well as I think he probably had a better funded campaign. I think some of the other candidates just simply had trouble getting their message
plus
out.
Plus, he has experience running.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch Malcolm Graham as a councilman again. Remember, he served, what, three or four terms back in the 90s, early 2000s, and then he goes off to the state legislature, was in the state Senate, and has run a couple times for Congress. So just kind of what's his perspective? What does he want to focus on coming back to council?
And this council keeps getting younger, or not younger in terms of age, but in terms of experience. It was a huge shift 2 years ago, and now it just continues.
Yeah, because newcomers were the order of the day in all the candidates in District 3 and 4. So newcomers are going to – they won in those districts. Victoria Watlington in District 3, Renee Perkins-Johnson in District 4, Matt Newton, the incumbent in District 5, won easily. There was no primary in District 6, where Republican incumbent Tarek Bakari will face Democrat Gina Navarrete in November. Who is she? Anybody know anything about her? Okay. And Republican Ed Driggs handily declared victory in District 7. How many of these candidates are virtual shoe-ins in November because of the demography of Charlotte?
I think that the District 6 race that we just talked about, Republicans have won that. It's a South Charlotte seat. They've won it easily for many, many years, as we just talked about with Dan McCready. It's getting more blue. But I think there's a very difference between kind of a big high-profile federal election where a lot of people come out, and a November election would really – I mean, this turnout is going to be really, really low.
What was turnout this time? Was it
– It was 21.5%, which compared to 2 years ago, you had 8%. But that's because of what Steve's saying, because you had that South Charlotte pocket voting in that federal race. And I think it was 37% in the entire NC9 district.
So. And I also read that a lot of people came out to vote and were surprised that they weren't in District 9. They came out to vote for one of the Dans and found out they couldn't because they weren't in the district.
Yeah, the turnout was higher, like, all over the city. Yeah. Like, it wasn't just, like, District 9 and then a few little precincts next to it where people were confused. I mean, there was much higher turnout compared to September 2017, way far away from District 9.
Which I think is a function of all those ads, and you're right. People just, we're all going out to vote for one of the Dans. So
looking ahead to the general election in November, remember, we've got the arts referendum. And if we have a very low turnout, as it could be, we could have just a handful of people deciding that important
issue.
That's
an excellent point, Glenn, particularly because we haven't heard much about it since the initial debate. I'm assuming that campaign is coming soon, but I haven't seen really any of it yet.
I think they're kicking off tonight.
There you go.
So we had yes, they have a party for the arts thing, right, tonight? Is that right?
Yep.
We had Republican presidential candidate Mark Sanford, the former South Carolina governor, on this program on Wednesday to talk about why he's running against Donald Trump. Bill Weld and Joe Walsh are also running. Weld feels that Trump is unfit for office. Walsh has similar feelings. Sanford says he's running because he sees financial disaster looming large.
We're headed down the wrong road, and I think that we need to change course. I think we're walking our way toward the most predictable financial crisis in the history of man.
Of course, South Carolina has canceled their GOP primary, so he will not get to run in his own state in that primary. And although Sanford told us that if Trump ended up being the nominee, he'd probably be predisposed to vote for him, Trump has called his three GOP challengers a joke. They're a laughingstock, he says. The Three Stooges is what he calls them. Okay.
I just going to say, Mike, I thought in the interview with Sanford, I thought one of the most interesting points was you asked him about impeachment.
Yeah.
And his answer was kind of like, nah, I don't think it's good strategically, was kind of basically what he said. I just thought that was interesting in that, I mean, because clearly spending too much money is not an impeachable offense. But his answer to you seemed to be kind of like, I heard it as, yeah, but it's not good. It's just not good tactics. I thought he may be right about that.
I thought one of the more interesting points, his whole point for running, or at least one of his primary points for running, is because the deficit is too high, and he says we have to get spending under control. But when you ask him point blank what he would cut, he never really answered.
He didn't answer, and I said, well, then you have to raise taxes, right? No.
Well, and didn't he vote for the Trump tax cut when he was in Congress?
He did.
I believe he did. So that's a problem.
He explained that away as well.
So, 101, you have to have stuff coming in before you can have it go out. Just basic
look at
math.
That. Guns and butter math. With Mike Collins.
Three lots in Plaza Midwood have been announced for sale. Now, these are 12 acres in an area that's up and coming, and right now they house what, Danielle?
So, right now it's a shopping center and a parking lot that has gotten a lot of attention for booting people. And
because they park there and don't shop there?
Yeah, and there's a lot of surrounding businesses and, you know, bars in Plaza Midwood, and it's very hard to find parking on the street.
This is the shopping center where the Roasting Company, CVS, Bistro Le Bon, and Five Guys are located.
Yeah.
My gosh, it's Restaurant Row, except for the CVS. Do they have a lunch counter?
There's an ABC store.
Okay. Has it been sold, or is it just up for sale?
It's up for sale, and they actually didn't have a list price on there, but the properties valued, the three parcels together are valued at $18 million.
And why is this news? I mean, I know it is, but why is it news?
This is probably the biggest kind of piece of land, assuming someone bought all three parcels together in Plaza Midwood, to be kind of developed, and it's been such a changing area.
Is it likely to stay the way it is, maybe upfit it a little bit like they did the Park Road Shopping Center, or is it likely to become a five-story apartment building?
You know, I don't know what would happen to the existing shops, but I do think it's pretty likely that the parking lot is going to be redeveloped. It's such a large lot, and it's such valuable land that I can't see someone buying it to keep it as a parking lot.
Okay. Meanwhile, if you're looking for a house, good luck to you. it ain't happening. Inventory of homes for sale in Charlotte fell 17.5% in August from the year before. Is that because fewer people are moving? Or is it because more people are moving in than we have homes to put them in?
Yeah, it's more people are coming here than we have supply of homes. You know, we're not building enough. And then, you know, people are staying in their homes a lot longer because it's becoming more expensive. So it's kind of this cycle of, you know, I want to move up, but I can't afford another house. So I'm going to stay. And
because the price
all these
of a
people
home,
moving
the,
here.
The median sales price rose 5.2%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's over $250,000 at
this
point.
How do you fix this? This is bad news for realtors.
You know, it's,
how do you fix it?
It's kind of hard to see what the solution is because, you know, everyone keeps saying, well, this isn't sustainable. At some point, people aren't going to be able to afford the price if it just keeps going up. But it's done this for multiple years.
Also, the supply of single family homes mm-hmm. is lower than the supply of condos. Is that because there are more condos or fewer people who want to live in condos?
It's not. The supply is not lower. The decline was less. So there has been a lot of townhome development. And I think part of that is because in Charlotte, you know, there's such little available land to build on, and townhomes take up less space.
Right.
But yeah, I'm sure that I would imagine the demand for single-family homes is probably higher, but the decline was steeper for
So we have about a minute left, somewhere in that neighborhood. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden, because of his stance on cooperating with ICE, was mentioned many times in the recent District 9 campaign, and on Monday, McFadden fired back at his critics, which include Vice President Mike Pence. Republicans have said that he has released dangerous criminals back into our midst. Pence said, quote, instead of being deported, these criminals are being released here in North Carolina. What was McFadden's response?
So he's basically said that, you know, first of all, these are voluntary requests. It's not a warrant. And he's basically said that it's not up to him to release someone from jail. It's up to a magistrate or a judge. And there's also been kind of conflicting accounts of this, but he said it's possible that it could be unconstitutional.
Yes.
As well, and it sort of breeds distrust in immigrants.
And he also threw it back on ICE. He said, if ICE believed this young man was that dangerous, why wait 3 years to notify any law enforcement agency that he's in your city? You have to think if they had charged him and put a warrant on him when he cut off his ankle bracelet 3 years ago, wouldn't he have been arrested? Good point. And we'll end with that. Eric Spanberg is with us from the Charlotte Business Journal. Daniel Shemtov, the last voice you heard other than mine, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I've already said you. Glenn Birkins here from Q City Metro, and Steve Harrison from WFAE.
I'm here.
Yeah. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.